Hopefully you've had a chance to read through the book of Nehemiah, as we've been encouraging you to do over the last couple of weeks. It is a ripping read. As I said, it's not a very long book. Get your favourite beverage and you can read through it quite quickly. Actually, next week we're doing a whole book as well. We're doing the book of Jude. And not quite the same though, sir, because by the time the jug is boiled, you've finished reading Jude. But it'd be a good idea to read ahead anyway. And one of the things I wonder if you've noticed as we've looked at the book of Nehemiah is that at various times it's a bit of a roller coaster. What I mean by that is, in many ways, it starts at a low point, which is obvious because the city is in ruins and the wall is down and Nehemiah hears about it and he goes into fast and pray. It's a bit of a low point. That's the way the story begins. But then we know that he goes before King Artaxerxes and he gets permission to go back to Jerusalem. And when he goes back to Jerusalem, he encourages the leaders to get with him and to rebuild the wall. And they all go, yay! And so it's a high point in the story. But then we know almost immediately that there's this opposition from people who are laughing at him and saying, why are you doing this? Which is a low point. But then they actually do get together and they rebuild the wall. 52 days. They plug up all the gaps and they get the whole thing organised. So it's a high point. So you can see how it's sort of going up and down. It's like a roller coaster. But then again, there's more opposition. Low point. But then they get the book of the law out and they read the book of the law and find out what God requires of them and they say, yes, that's what we're going to do. High point. And in fact, actually, if you then read the last couple of chapters, which we're looking at tonight, you'll see that you almost stay on this high point for a bit because the very next thing they do is they dedicate the wall. High point. And I wish the story ended there. But it doesn't. It ends on a low point. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. We're going to get there in just a moment. But what I do want to do is address briefly two things that you might have read if you were reading ahead, that you might go, what on earth is going on there? And this is two things I want to address quite briefly. The first is, you will notice in chapter 11 that there's all these strange references to people moving back into Jerusalem. Now, what's going on there? Well, the issue is that they rebuilt the wall of Jerusalem, but Jerusalem was still not very heavily populated. There weren't a lot of people in Jerusalem. And so Nehemiah wants to make sure that they get the whole system going again. So he is encouraging people to come back. And what he does is he gets the census records. We're about to do our census in a couple of weeks' time. But he gets the census records and he finds out the families that used to live in Jerusalem. And then he tries to encourage them to move back to Jerusalem where they'd come from. The other thing that happens from, you see in chapter 11, is references to the priests and the Levites moving back into Jerusalem. Now, what had happened here, this is quite significant. You see, the priests and the Levites, their job was to conduct the work of the temple, wasn't it? The priests were involved in all the sacrificial stuff, and the Levites were like the helpers, they were like the gophers that helped the priests do the job. So that's their whole purpose, that's what their whole job was. But you see, because the whole temple system had just come crashing down, the priests and Levites had nothing to do, as it were, and in order to put food on the table, had moved out and had either bought land or worked somebody else's land or found a job or whatever it was to put food on their table, which sounds like a good thing. You know, they're feeding their family, working for their food. But the problem was, it's because the temple system wasn't working. And so Nehemiah says it's not right, and he gets all the priests and the Levites to move back to Jerusalem and to start once again the whole sacrificial system, which was read about last week when we looked at the book of the law and that role that it played. So that's one of the first things you notice as you come to the end of this book. The other thing you notice is in chapter 12 there is this description of the dedication of the wall. And it's really quite intriguing. Have a look at chapter 12 and verse 27. At the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, the Levites were sought out from where they lived and were brought to Jerusalem to celebrate joyfully the dedication with songs of thanksgiving, with the music of cymbals, harps and lyres. The singers also were brought together from the region around Jerusalem. And then jump to verse 31. I had the leaders of Judah go up on top of the wall. I assigned two large choirs to give thanks. One was to proceed on top of the wall to the right towards the Dung Gate. And then verse 38, the second choir proceeded in the opposite direction. I followed them on the top of the wall together with half the people past the Tower of the Ovens to the broad wall. And then finally, verse 43, and on that day they offered great sacrifices, rejoicing because God had given them great joy. The women and the children also rejoiced. The sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem could be heard far away. What do you see going on there? Well, it's a celebration. It's a party even. It's a dedicating of the wall. And it's really quite intriguing. You know, they've got two choirs. And I was having a bit of fun with the 9:15 service this morning, because if you know, the 9:15 service has a choir. And so I sort of said, maybe we should have two choirs. And they all went, yes! To which I then said, well, wait a second. If you're going to take it literally, we have to do the rest of it literally as well. No organ. No. Can't have an organ. Can't have piano. It's not written there. What's written there? Well, did you see what instruments are written there? Harps, lyres and cymbals. To which I then said, how about I just go start playing the cymbals on the drum kit and you tell me when you're enjoying it, okay? The point being made here is that the wall is finished and they dedicate the wall. And it's right and it's proper to celebrate. And we see that all the time, don't we? A few weeks ago when we reopened the cathedral, there was a great celebration with that. My hope too is that when we come and finish our buildings, that maybe we too might have a great celebration. I don't know about two choirs walking around the eaves on top of the roof, but anyway, we'll see how we're going to do it. And if that's how the book of Nehemiah finished, it would be good. We would have finished on a high point. But if you see in your Bibles in front of you, there's an extra chapter, isn't there? Chapter 13. And sadly in chapter 13 you see it ends on a low point. The background for chapter 13 is that Nehemiah has actually gone back to Persia. Now the thing to remember is Nehemiah, when he came to Jerusalem, he was there for 12 years. Now I don't know about you, but we've been doing our sort of building scheme from around about 2010. So what does that make it? About 6 years of doing all our building stuff? He was there for another 6 years on top of that. That's a long building scheme, isn't it? 12 years. And after 12 years, when he thought everything was organised and going, he went back to Persia, because you remember the king said, when are you coming back? So he went back. But then the king said he could go back and check it out. And we're going to pick up the story in chapter 13 from verse 6. But while all this was going on, I, that's Nehemiah, was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I returned to the king. Sometime later I asked his permission and came back to Jerusalem. And here I learned about the evil thing Eliashib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. And I was greatly displeased and threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the room. And I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and the incense. What's going on here? Nehemiah, he returns, and all of a sudden, it appears that he sort of loses his temper, and he sees that Tobiah's got a room in the temple, and he throws everything that was Tobiah's in the room out and has this cleansing ritual of some sort of sort. What's going on? Well, you need to realise who Tobiah is. Now, we've read the book of Nehemiah, haven't we? You know who Tobiah is. And if you can't quite remember, let me remind you. Who was one of the people who opposed Nehemiah all the way through? Answer? Tobiah. Who was it that through marriage and through other sorts of interesting relationships wormed his way in to have great influence? Answer? Tobiah. Who was it that was an Ammonite and has now a room in the temple? You need to sort of go with me on this one. Answer? Tobiah. He was an Ammonite. And you think, what's that got to do with it? Well, when the Israelites had left Egypt and were going through the wilderness to the promised land, the Ammonites didn't help them. And God remembered and said, they will not have a place in his temple. But the final thing that you need to remember is Tobiah has a room in the temple. And what is he doing in that room? He's storing all his household gear. Instead of what being stored? Well, look what Nehemiah puts back in. The tithes of grain, new wine, oil prescribed for the Levites, the singers and the gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. This is verse 5, sorry. That were meant to be back in there. Tobiah had taken the room over that all the stuff that the Levites and priests were meant to use was meant to be housed. So basically what's happening is Tobiah's got back into the temple and the whole temple system has been thrown into chaos again because Tobiah's taken over the place. And Nehemiah's coming back and saying, I thought we had this worked out. No wonder Nehemiah gets so upset and throws everything out. In fact, it reminds me of someone who would do it several hundred years later. See, the real issue is, it's not just that Tobiah was there, but they had gone against the declaration that they had made. Just a moment ago, we had chapter 9, verse 38 read. Just have a look at it again. Chapter 9, verse 38. In view of all this, we are making a binding agreement, putting it into writing, and our leaders, our Levites, and our priests are affixing their seals to it. So they're making a binding agreement. And what is that binding agreement? Well, it has various aspects, but jump to chapter 10, verse 39. The people of Israel, including the Levites, are to bring their contributions of grain, new wine, and oil to the storerooms where the articles for the sanctuary are kept and where the ministering priests, the gatekeepers, and the singers stay. And note this last bit. We will not neglect the house of our God. We will not neglect the house of our God. And what are they doing by letting Tobiah back in? Neglecting the house of God. They're going back on the very promise and declaration that they had made. In fact, what you see is that everything that led to the exile in the beginning is now starting again. They are going back on their dedication to the Lord. There's an old saying that old habits die hard. You may have used that. You may have had your parents use that. You may have used it as an excuse at various times. Oh, you know what it's like. Old habits die hard. Here's my question. Is it a good excuse? You see, old habits might die hard, but they must die. They must. Nehemiah appears to go off his rocker because he realizes where this will end up. It will continue, bit by bit, going against the declaration that they made. And it's not just Tobiah getting a room in the temple. It's in everything that they declared that they would do just a couple of chapters earlier when the book of the law was read out. In fact, it gets worse. Have a look at chapter 13. So chapter 13 and verse 15. In those days I saw men in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with wine, grapes, figs and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. And then in verse 23, moreover, in those days I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Now, if you cast your minds back to, again, the book of the law being read last week, they said that they wouldn't do these things. They said that they wouldn't trade on the Sabbath. And they said that they wouldn't intermarry with the people around them. And all the stuff about the rooms and the temple. And they made a declaration that they would follow God again. And here they are going back on it. And Nehemiah comes back and suddenly realizes that they're backsliding, to use that old term. And you might be saying, well, come on, Greg, it's not that bad. Look, it's, you know, we've got Sunday trading. What's the real issue here? You know, what's this whole big thing about Sabbath? Well, didn't we just talk about the Ten Commandments a moment ago? Isn't it one of the commandments, number four? And you've got to understand the background of the idea of Sabbath. You see, Sabbath was meant to be a time in which you stopped to rest and to refresh. It was God-given authority to stop. But it also had a flip side to it, which was that it actually showed that you trusted God because you took time out to rest. I've known farmers who do not harvest on Sunday to show their trust in God. That's a big call. Now, I think we can argue theologically that we should still have a Sabbath, a day off. I'm not sure I can argue theologically that it must be Sunday. And let me give you some examples of where it might get tricky. I've probably just broken the Sabbath then. All day I've been working. And let me give you another example. You get sick on a Sunday, you're going to call an ambulance? Oh, that means they've got to now work on the Sabbath. You see what I mean? But I actually think it's right and proper that we have times of rest. And you might say, okay, I get the Sabbath thing, but what's the whole thing about the intermarrying thing? That just sounds like racism, Greg. You know, that just sounds like right-wing politics. No. Again, got to understand the background. God's people were not meant to intermarry, because what went with marrying people from other cultures? The worship of the gods of those cultures. The classic example, King Solomon. How many wives? Yeah, 307. I lost count. 700 plus 300 concubines. Well, okay, there you go. So, not only is that a whole issue, but what went with that was all the worship of the gods of the 700 wives and concubines. The point is, old habits might die hard, but they must die. This is serious, because going back on their dedication to the Lord is actually what got them into trouble in the first place with the exile and the crashing down of Jerusalem and so on and so forth. And the interesting thing is that when you read the end of the book of Nehemiah, do you notice when you get to the right to the end of Nehemiah, it never says, and they lived happily ever after. It never says that. You're left to wonder, how did they end up? And sadly, if you know the story of the Old Testament, you know that it didn't necessarily end well. And in fact, as I mentioned just a few moments ago, some 400 years later, the Lord Jesus himself would walk back into that same temple space and go through a very similar process, and would stand up and declare, "My Father's house is meant to be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." So what's the point here for us? Well, it can be fun sometimes to think about what's the wrong application of this passage to us. So let's just do that for a moment. What's the wrong application, so that we don't all get it wrong? Firstly, when you consider Tobiah and him having a room in the temple, the wrong application of that would be to say, well, that's it. We can't hire our rooms out to anybody who doesn't have anything to do with the church. That's the wrong application of that, okay? The wrong application of the Sabbath thing is, again, to argue that, oh, okay, you must have Sunday, or technically if you want to be Old Testament, Friday evening to Saturday evening, and nothing happens in the world at that time. Well, that's not going to work either, and I don't think you can argue for that theologically. That's being legalistic. That's, you know, us being made for the Sabbath rather than the Sabbath being made for us. And the wrong application of the problem with intermarrying into other ethnic groups, the wrong application of that would be obvious, wouldn't it? To say, you can't marry someone from a different ethnic group. Which would be stupid, and also a total mockery of what you see at the end of the Bible. Because what do you see at the end of the Bible? What do you see right at the end of Revelation? You see a large crowd, don't you? And how is that large crowd around the throne of God described? From every nation, from every tribe and from every tongue, and they are all praising God. So they're the wrong applications. What is the right application? Well, I think it's the point I've been trying to make all the way through. Old habits might die hard, but they must die. The Apostle Paul puts it this way: the old has gone, the new has come. The old is gone, new has come. It's got a technical term, sanctification. It basically means becoming more like Jesus every day. The old self has been put to death and the new has come. And each day becoming more like Jesus. Each day recommitting ourselves to following the Lord. It's amazing how when we say confession together as a people, part of the prayer of a good confession prayer is to then ask God to help us to live out our faith after confessing our sins. Because there will be times when we slip up. But with determination and with our hope in God, we live for Him each day more like Jesus. And I actually think Zacchaeus is a good example of this. You know the story that was read for us just before about Zacchaeus? One of the Sunday school favourites, isn't it? Well, I'm sure anyone who ever went to Sunday school or the equivalent in any church growing up can always remember the story of Zacchaeus, because Zacchaeus was a little man and he climbed the sycamore tree. That's the bit we always remember. But you've got to remember what happened next after that. See, Zacchaeus was the chief tax collector. And when Jesus goes to his home, at the end of the night, Jesus says, "Salvation has come to this house, for this man too is a son of Abraham." Now, how can Jesus say that? This is the chief tax collector. This is a guy who rips the system off and so on and so forth. How can Jesus say it? Because just before Jesus says it, Zacchaeus says, "I will give half my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anyone," which I always think of, yes, you have, "I will pay them back four times." I have no doubt that Zacchaeus heard the message that Jesus was talking about, the hope that Jesus offered, and Zacchaeus professed faith in it and started to follow Jesus that time. And as he followed Jesus, his actions then met his profession of faith. And that's the point. Our actions have to match the faith we profess. Old habits might die hard, but they must die. Let me bring it to a very controversial and even a moment from this time. You may have seen the 7:30 report the other night. It was about the pedophile ring in the Newcastle Diocese. If you didn't get to see it, don't worry. You will get to see it in the media in the weeks to come. Because the most amazing thing is that the Royal Commission hasn't even really begun to investigate or have the hearings about Newcastle. They're coming in the weeks to come. But the story was broken by the ABC the other day. And as I was watching this story about the pedophile ring that was done by the priests in the church in the Newcastle Diocese, I sat there with two feelings, two emotions running through my body at the same time. One was of great sadness for the abused and all who were caught up in that and were hurt greatly. Such great sadness. And then incredible rage and anger at the system to allow it and the people who did it. Same time. And I thought to myself, how can this happen? And what I also thought to myself was the damage this will do to the church and to the gospel. And people will rightly say, "You did not practice what you preached." And they will rightly say it. And they have every right to say it. Because Jesus gave them that right to say it. Jesus is the one who said to the world, "You will know which are my disciples by their actions." I don't want to get into the exercise of trying to rank which sin is worse than which sin. Okay, that's I have no time for that. The behaviour of what happened in Newcastle is unbelievable. But the question we all need to ask ourselves is, are we practicing what we preach? Does our actions match up with what we profess? Or, like the people in Nehemiah, are we going back on what we declare? Let me ask you, do we have old habits? No doubt. Will they die hard? I'm sure of it. Must they die? Definitely. Not just for our own sake, but for God's sake. For God's honour. In fact, that's basically what the whole book of Nehemiah is about. From the beginning to the end, it's about God's honour. In the very beginning, God is in disgrace because his city is in shambles, because his people rejected him, and God does something about it. This book of Nehemiah is not some 2,500-year-old building program. That just happens to be the backstory. This is a 2,500-year lesson in that it's always about God's honour. Old habits might die hard, but for the honour of the Lord, everything we do, everything we say, everything we think, and everything we build must indeed be for Him. Old habits die hard, but they must die. Let me pray for us.